amplifier votre passion pour la guitare pour quelques euros par mois. Rendez-vous sur lachaineguitare.com. Amplify your passion for the guitar for a few dollars per month. Head over to theguitarchannel.biz. Welcome to the Guitar Channel. I am super happy to welcome you a new interview. I have on the other side of the FaceTime connection, the one and only Jason Sine. Jason, how are you doing today?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
I'm great. I mean, it's really a great pleasure to be able to do that. So thank you very much for your time. How is the situation in Los Angeles for you at the moment, Jason?
It's completely crazy.
Okay.
It's the center of the COVID pandemic in the States. And a lot of people I know have gotten it, and I haven't, but I have a lot of guitars to play, so I just stay quarantined and play guitar all day.
Okay, that's a good good situation at the end of the day. Tell me, what was and what is the impact of the pandemic on your life as a musician so far?
Well, I mean, it had a very immediate impact on my career in that my band, The Dirty Knobs, was just about to go on tour in March, right before the release of our record, which we eventually delayed. And it was about 10 days before we were supposed to go on tour, the lockdown happened. Mm-hmm. So it was very, it was horrible. I mean, we were so looking forward to going out and playing. And so that was hard, but I immediately figured I can't sit here and be depressed. I've got to stay focused and keep working and be creative. So I got really into building my studio out and creating content, and I've just made the most out of it.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So no life as a working musician at the moment. Are you still able to work from home, from your home studio? What is paying the bill at the end of the month at the moment?
Well, I can. I've done quite a few sessions from my home studio, which has been great. And our record came out, and it's done extremely well and much better than we anticipated.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a good thing that I own some real estate also, because okay. That helps pay the bills.
Okay, that's good. So we are going to talk about Reckless Abandon, of course. But first, you have to tell me, Jason, what was your very first guitar?
My very first guitar was a Yamaha 3/4 size acoustic guitar. I played on that guitar for 2 years and 8 months before I got a electric guitar.
Okay.
And it was hard to play.
Did you add any guitar teacher? What was the initial inspiration to pick up the guitar? Was it to pick up girls, or what was it?
Well, that's always been my inspiration.
Yeah, right.
But I mean, I think that's why I stuck with the guitar.
Okay.
But the original inspiration was simply I was at my dad's office. He was in the magazine business. Yamaha sold guitars in the back of his magazine. They had advertising. They sent him these couple guitars. I said, "What's that?" He said, "It's a guitar." I took it home, and that was it. I fell in love with it on the first day.
Mm-hmm. And when did you know that you wanted to become a professional musician? What was at what age?
Well, that's a really good question. At 9, I wanted to be a rock star.
Okay, cool.
And around 15, I wanted to be a professional musician.
Okay.
And a rock star.
And what are the main turning points in your career between that very first Yamaha and the album we're going to talk about after that?
Well, I think I was very fortunate that my uncle on my mother's side he's still around. He just doesn't do it anymore. But he was one of the biggest jingle composer producers in Los Angeles through the 70s and the 80s. So as a kid, I would hang out in the studio with him. And that's sort of how I got my start as a studio musician, was once he saw I was good enough and he knew he didn't have to pay me, he said, "You play that."
Okay.
So that's sort of how it started. And I took lessons twice a week. I worked very hard to get better. I was very lucky to be exposed to the studio scene in LA during that period, because even commercials for cereal were played by the same guys that played on the Steely Dan record.
Yeah.
Same musicians.
So
that was very cool.
So you were first and foremost a studio guy then?
I mean, I like playing live more, but I'm very comfortable in the studio, and I love the process.
Okay.
I really do.
And who are the most memorable session you played on, either with famous or not famous people? I mean, being a guitar musician, a studio musician, is quite a job, so you must have plenty of stories to tell.
I've had a few that were very scary, but great.
Okay.
I think the one that jumps out was Neil Diamond.
Okay.
Because it was something I got brought in. Rick Rubin produced it, and Jim Scott engineered it, and Jim and I were really good friends. And Mike Campbell played on it, and Ben Montench played on it. And I couldn't believe when Neil walked in, because usually with those big stars, you know, you come in, you play, you make a track, then they come in later. But he wanted to be in the room with the guys and play acoustic guitar with us, and it was... It was, for me, it was a big moment because I love Neil Diamond, especially the performance in The Last Waltz that he did with the band. It just blew me away as a kid. And that's why I'm wearing these glasses.
Okay.
This is my Neil Diamond look. But his professionalism and how kind he was and how into it he was blew my mind because he's a superstar. But he just was one of the guys.
Mm.
So that was a great experience.
Mm-hmm. What is the secret to be a successful studio musician?
If I knew that, I would be... I mean, I'm an interesting type of studio musician. People think I'm much more technical than I am. And I'm not. It's just that I'm not afraid to ask the other musicians, what is that chord?
Okay.
How do you play that? Mm-hmm. What is this? I have no ego about it. I don't care. So, I mean, I care, but I don't mind letting them know, I don't know what you're doing. What do I play here? So I think that's something that's helped me a lot because people tend to appreciate it instead of faking it, saying, hey, man, what is that? You know, what's going on? So, but I'm mostly a feel musician. I like to play in the groove. And I think that more than being a good player, I think showing up on time, having good instruments that stay in tune,
okay,
and listening to the producer and doing what he's asking you, not what you think he's asking you or your idea of what he's asking you, but be part of it and be, you know, just be another color in the palette. You know, I think that's helped me a lot get called back to work with people.
Mm-hmm. Is there still a studio scene in Los Angeles, or now it's really gone and because everybody's working from home, not only because of the pandemic, because it was already the case before? So do you still work? Let's put aside the pandemic for a moment. Did you still have job to on session or not really anymore?
Not really. I mean, compared to how it was even 10 years ago, it's very, very different, where it seems that there's these groups in LA, these sort of cliques, if you will, or clubs of certain musicians that work together.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in a few of those cliques, so those are great, but most of those aren't done in big studios anymore. Most of those type of sessions are done at someone's house. Like, in fact, in this place, I just finished, basically 2 weeks ago, the studio upstairs, which is not even a traditional studio. It's just set up in a way where I can put drums back there, feed it up to the studio, I can put the bass player above me. It's sort of set up COVID friendly, but after COVID, I can still record a record here. And I mean, I have all the gear, I have all the mics. So with a great engineer, you can make a good record anywhere.
Mm-hmm. And when people want to have Jason Sine on their record, what are they? What do they want? Is it a specific sound? Is it a specific approach to songwriting? Is that your songwriting skill? Is that all of the above?
Well, I think mostly I've been called in for things. It's either they want a full-on lead guitar player who's going to play lots of parts, right, and build sort of something. But I'm stupid because I always say to them, can I bring my other friend and play together? It'll be much better than just me doing all the parts. And they're like, well, we don't have it in the budget. And I'm like, But I prefer two guitar players playing at the same time. But I think what they look for, basically, most of the time, they want really great tone. Everyone talks about tone.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone
mm-hmm.
I talk to, we want your tone. We want that sound. How do you get that sound? We want that sound on the record. And over the years, especially working with Mike Campbell, I mean, my tone when I met Mike was this, and now it's grown immensely because when you work with someone like that as a master of tone, you kind of have to step up.
But what,
I've learned a lot about how to get the right amps and the right guitars with the right volumes and the right settings.
Mm-hmm.
It helps a lot.
So when you mean that your tone is bigger, do you mean that your palette is wider now?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's wider, and my basic tone is just my sort of go-to tone is way, 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 way better. And that came about by simply us playing in clubs with the early Dirty Knobs, coming in with our big basement Fenders and all these rigs and realizing we can't use these rigs in these little clubs. We have to bring it down. And then we would bring it down to midsize. And then we finally got all the way down to using, you know, a 60s Princeton and a 50s Deluxe together. You know, we're talking 18 watts, 22 watts, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And we can hear the sound on stage is great. They pump it through the house, and it sounds amazing.
Mm-hmm. I remember I saw you playing with the Dirty Knobs. I think it was at the Winternam 2 or 3 years ago. And it was a great concert, and there was a lot of amps on stage.
Yeah.
And it was great, great memories, because I think, yeah, it was definitely the very first time I saw you play on stage. I think Mike, maybe it was even the first time he got on stage after the passing of Tom Petty. Could this be?
I think it was.
Yeah. And it was a great concert. So before we talk about that, tell me a little bit more about the story of the Dirty Knobs. What was the beginning of that band?
So I was in a band in the 90s called Five Easy Pieces. And this man, a producer engineer that we picked to do the record, he's passed, unfortunately, but he, a brilliant, brilliant guy named Don Smith. And he's worked with everyone. You know, he did Keith Richards and the Expensive Winos. That's all him. He did that. He did so many records we all loved. So we thought, we want to work with this guy. So he and I, even after I left that band, he and I stayed. He started hiring me for sessions all the time. And then he started working with me on my own music and producing me. And then I think the year 2000. It was the year 2000. One day I went over to his house and Mike Campbell was there. You know, just
no
sitting
big deal.
In the studio.
Okay.
Mike played on our record, actually, but
okay.
We weren't there when he played.
Mm-hmm.
I got totally scared. I just sat in the corner, just didn't look at him. You know, and Mike wasn't looking at me and I wasn't looking at him. And then Mike laughed and I was like, Don, why didn't you warn me? He goes, I don't know. He just came out. And then about 2 months later, Don called me and says, hey, I need you at a session. Here's the address. Da, 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 it's a house. Just show up with a Gretsch. You don't need an amp. I'm like, okay. Nothing. No effects pedals. Nothing. No, no, no. You don't need anything. It's all there. And I rang the bell, and it was Mike Campbell's house.
Okay.
And I'm looking, and I didn't know what was happening. So next thing I know, I'm in a room with Mike Campbell, Ben Montench, Steve Ferroni, and Ron Blair. And I'm thinking, well, what's wrong with this picture? What doesn't fit with the others? You know? All I remember is plugging in, and I know we recorded for about 12 to 15 hours.
Okay.
And song after song after song after song. Mostly covers and some of Mike's originals. I don't know why we did the session. I don't know what it was about, but it was hard work, man. I had a hard time keeping up with these guys. So the session ends. I leave. I'm devastated because I thought I was terrible. And 2 days later, Mike Campbell called me and said, I've been listening to these tracks and we play really well together. And he said, hey, we sound good together, man. You want to come back and play with me more? And I'm looking at the phone thinking, this is what my heroes. And that's how it started. So we basically started just recording songs.
Okay. So it was some kind of an audition, or did they try other guitar players? You don't know?
No.
Okay.
I mean, what Don told me was, I think what happened was Mike talked to someone. I forgot who he went to, but he played someone some of his demos, I guess, is the story. And the guy said to him, and it was a big guy, like a big major guy, producer. And he said, you know what? You need another guitar player that doesn't sound like you. Kind of like how you and Tom have this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So what he wanted, what Mike was telling Don, was like, I want someone, but I don't want someone famous and well-known. I want someone who's really, really good and just wants to do it for the love of it. And he goes, I got the guy for you. I got him. I'm telling you, this guy's perfect. And it worked.
Nice.
Because it just, you never know with two guitar players. It works or it doesn't.
Mm-hmm. You know? So right from the start, there was this kind of alchemy between you guys when you started the band.
Yeah.
Then. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Big time.
All right. Let's talk about the album. So Reckless Abandon, so who was just released like back in September, right? Something like that?
No, it was really... Yeah, when was it released?
It was supposed to be March. It was pushed back to September. Anyway.
No, actually, it was released... I think it was released in November.
November. Okay, so last month.
Yeah.
And a great record, full of great song, lot of cool guitar tones and guitar playing and so on. So tell us the whole story. How was it composed? Was it just... Mike Campbell's song, and then you work on it, or was how did it happen?
Well, mostly 90% of the time or more, Mike will come to us, whether we're recording or rehearsing for a show, and say, "Oh, I got a couple new songs." Well, Mike writes every day.
Okay,
he's the most prolific songwriter. So we laugh like, okay, Mike, you got a couple new songs, and they're all
what's new. They're, okay,
they're generally incredible, like incredible songs. Like it would be any artist's best song ever is a song that he throws away. So he will bring in, and he'll kind of play a couple things. Like kind of goes like this, and then he counts it off, and we just play.
Okay,
and 93% of the time, Mike looks at us like, how'd you do that? That's perfect. But once in a while, he'll say maybe to the bass player or the drummer or to me, one of us, hey, could you just try this? And we'll arrange it right there. We'll try different things, or one of us will have an idea. Hey, maybe try this, or maybe go one extra bar. But generally, I think Mike kind of knows when he's writing, he knows how we're going to play. He knows what we're going to do. And my role as a guitarist in this band is to support Mike and, you know, support him as the lead singer, support him as the leader, and also to find a space for my rhythm and whatever I'm doing, parts, rhythm, even solo stuff, it's got to fit. It's all got to be part of it. But basically, Mike just comes in and we play it. Sometimes he'll play us a demo where he played every instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And we listen to it once, then we play it, basically how he played it. And it's great. It's just perfect. All the parts are done.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us an example of the guitar parts you are playing and compared to what Mike is playing, if you pick one example of one song of the album, and maybe you can fake Mike's guitar part and then after that play your part and explain how both of them interact with each other?
Okay, so for instance, like on one of the songs on the record, which is one of the oldest tunes on the record, is called Loaded Gut. Mm-hmm. So the lick is, Mike starts it. Let me turn up a little. So he's doing that lick, and I start off with just a very simple, when I come in, I'll let that run, and then he's playing it. And then I just come in with a... So I'll ghost his lick.
Okay.
I'll play it a little bit, but mostly just locking in with the bass and the drums really, really, really tight. And he's like, and he's just playing that, and I'm just, and then I'll accent it in little funny ways so it's not too perfect.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it creates this like beautiful kind of mess, but it's in time. That makes sense.
And
things like that.
And what happened when it's time for a solo? He say, okay, go now, or you wink, or what do you, how do you do it?
Well, that's, yeah, well, Mike, he does this to me all the time. So he doesn't like it when I think. So he likes it when I don't know what's going to happen next.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we have a song on the record called Fuck That Guy.
Oh, yeah. Great.
And
fun.
I played the slide guitar on that, right? Well, it's an E flat.
Mm.
I don't like playing slide in flat keys. I don't like playing in flat keys. I'm a guitar player.
Yeah.
So he's like, hands me the guitar and says, you're going to play the slide on it. I said, you're Mike Campbell. The fans want to hear you, man. He goes, I don't want to do it. You do it. And we hit record, and it's the first take because I didn't know what I was doing.
Okay.
So that's kind of, Mike likes that. That makes him really happy. So, and on stage, we'll be going along and he'll be soloing like crazy and I'm really into the rhythm and he'll bring the band way down and he's like, go.
Okay.
I'm like, what?
Me? Now? Okay, go.
And sometimes he'll come over and whisper in my ear, Jimmy. And then I'll go, which Jimmy?
And you have to guess.
I have to guess. I'm like, he's like, you know it's Jimmy. But, you know, he gives me so much creative license. And he loves to bring the band down. And I see it. He thinks I don't see it. But I'm, like, looking at the guitar. And he's, like, pointing at the audience. Ah! You know, like, to cheer for me. It's very sweet.
Nice. What about the way you architecture the guitar tones between Mike and you? If he's playing a Les Paul, you pick a Strat, or you change amp, how do you divide, so, you know, the spectrum?
That's such a good question. And it's an interesting question because it's a really funny answer. So this guitar right here, this is, I call it number one.
Okay.
It's a 67 Strat that mm-hmm. is not original. Got a horrible refinished paint job. It's a mess. It's just a mess, but it's the best Strat I've ever played. And Mike, for probably the entire career of the Knobs, has wanted me to play this guitar the whole set.
Okay.
Like the whole set. Up until we were getting ready to go on tour. And then it changed because to do a real long tour, we worked very hard on, okay, you play a Gretsch, I'll play a Rickenbacker
mm-hmm.
on this one. And then, you know, I see what Mike's playing. Okay, he's playing a Tele. So I'll play a Strat that has a real dark tone, or maybe I'll play a Firebird, you know? So we basically try, and we'll start playing, and when it's not right, Mike is the first one to hear it. He's always like, wait, guitars are wrong, something's wrong. So we tune up, we go through it again. Nah, it's wrong. And he's like, try that guitar, whatever it may be. And then boom, everything's in tune and everything works. I don't know how he has that thing where you could just hear it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's basically what we've come to. But before that, I played the Strat and he played 6-7 different guitars per night.
Okay. And how was the album recorded? Was it live and you just you were doing the process you just described when you moved from one song to the other?
Well, it was very quick. I mean, we cut some of the record a while ago and some of it a year ago. So we had a few sort of 2-week periods where we went in and recorded. And we recorded, 40 tracks. I don't know how many tracks we recorded. But basically, it was at Mike's studio. We were all, everything was, amps and everything. Obviously, we're all in closets and here and there. The bass player, the drummer, and I were all in the drum room, with cans on. And Mike was behind the glass, singing and looking at us. And we would just... I don't think we played more than 2 takes of any effect on that record.
Wow.
We just blasted through it, even if it was a new song.
Mm-hmm.
Or something we had never recorded. But it was a really fun experience. And having George Drakoulias there made it really... It was just so nice. He's so cool. And he's so funny. And he keeps it light. But when something's wrong, he goes right in after it. Well, what's that? Let's take a look at that.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll listen back. He's like, okay, we're all excited and everything. And he'll say, yeah, I like the other one. And he was always right.
Mm-hmm. And who decide the songs? So there are, I think, 13 or 14 songs on the album. And you said you had 40. So who decided?
It was tough. We had them all written out on a board. And Mike and George picked them.
And everything, all the 40 songs were recorded?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Also, okay, so
not,
you have
maybe
like
not
a...
completely finished.
Okay.
Not done. But at least 20 are finished, or 25 are finished song.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was basically it. And we played live. I mean, it wasn't like no one, we played live. There's a few overdubs here and there, but the tracks are very live.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What is the guitar part you are most proud of on the record?
I'd say the slide thing I did on that song.
Okay.
I'm proud of it because if I was told ahead of time, you're going to play slide on this song, it's going to be an E flat, da da da, I would have never come up with that. I never would have done it because I would have overthought it, pondered it, and I didn't have time. So I'm proud of that. And some of the rhythm interplay on the song Reckless Abandon, I don't know what we did. We don't know. We can't figure it out what we did.
Okay.
We're trying to figure out what did we do? What guitar did I use? What tuning was I in? I know I had a capo. And when I listen to that with headphones on, I'm so proud of the way the rhythm guitars dance around each other. And then the bass is so melodic, but rocking.
Hmm.
It's a very interesting track.
Yeah, and the whole album is full of great songs, great melodies, and a lot of great harmonies too. Do you sing also on the album?
Yes. I love singing backgrounds.
Hmm.
I did it when I started out with Mike, but now I love it.
Okay. tell us about the cool guitars you used on the record. I mean, you are super well known for having quite a collection of vintage tools. So what did you use?
It's funny. When I go to Mike's, I don't bring a lot of guitars because he's got at least 3 times more than I do. So I played mostly this on the record.
That's your go-to guitar? Yeah.
And I played my Jerry Garcia guitar, the Lieber guitar, in a couple tracks.
Is that a replica of...
Yes.
Yeah? Okay, cool.
Mm-hmm. It's a replica of Jerry's. It is a wonderful, wonderful guitar. It's just fantastic. And I think I played Mike's 59 Les Paul on a couple things. So some pretty... And then I know I played a couple of his really cool Gretsch, you know, 60s Gretsch guitars. I forgot which ones. And I know I played, there was something on a Sheraton, an Epiphone Sheraton. I know I did some part on one of those.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all through a Princeton. I played through one little Princeton, the whole record.
All right. Just one amp and that's it?
That's it.
A couple of pedals? Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. What kind of tone toys did you use? Any secret pedals, top secret pedals?
Yes. My favorite, the one that's my favorite is, it's got a weird name. It's called a Camel Toe from Way Huge.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And 20 years ago, I saw that pedal because I knew I liked their green overdrive and I knew I liked their red llama. That pedal, the Camel Toe, all it is those two pedals in one. So you can choose which one or run them in a chain, which I don't suggest because it's so loud. I did that by accident playing with Waddy Wachtel one night, and Waddy plays louder than anyone on the planet. And he looked at me like, what are you doing? And it was pretty funny. So that pedal is incredible because it's, I turned Mike onto it when I met him. He bought two. I went and got a second one a few years later. Now they're all gone.
Okay.
There were only 19 made of the original.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And the new ones are great too, actually. But that pedal to me is a secret weapon because you can have a small amp. You can set the green side. It's just like a light boost overdrive. Not for soloing necessarily, but just to make your amp a little more. It's just more.
Mm-hmm.
And then you hit the red side for soloing, and it's just unbelievable distortion, but clean.
Mm-hmm.
Clean, but very aggressive.
Nice.
And it doesn't take anything away from your guitar tone.
Mm-hmm.
Your guitar can still speak through it. And most pedals don't do that. Most pedals that create distortion create noise or create, you know, you lose your bottom end, the bottom, or you lose top or whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm. Tell us the story about your 59 Burst. You do have one, right?
Oh my gosh. I just got it. I had a 60 and I sold that a year ago, like literally a year ago this week. And then I got a call about this guy.
Mm.
And I said, I am not ready for this. I can't do this now. And same guy that sold Mike his, and the same guy who sold me my first vintage guitar ever in the 80s. We've been friends for all these years, so I trust him 100%. And he said, just come over and try it. And I said, all right, well, we have to mask up and we got to be in a big room. He said, no problem. So I opened the case and I looked at it and I yelled at him. I said, why would you do this to me? He said, what did I do? I said, why would you show me this guitar? I'll never sleep. I'll never sleep again. He says, plug it in. You'll really never sleep.
It seems to be ultra clean, right? Or it's not...
It's so clean.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not mint, but it's close. And I played it and lost my mind. I just could not believe the tone.
Okay.
So he said, take it home for a few days and tell me what you're thinking. And I couldn't part with it. So it stayed here. And it's the best sounding Les Paul I've ever heard, ever.
And
I've never heard anything like it.
Do you think the market of vintage guitars is going to hold its value forever, or at one point the old guys like us are going to disappear, and the interest in vintage guitars is going to disappear also, or some guitars like the 59 Burst is going to stay there forever? What's your take on that?
I think that, you know, it's like anything, people like us understand what it is, where sometimes I talk to, you know, I mean, a lot of the younger players I talk to, they know about a Burst, but it's because they've heard about it.
Mm-hmm.
They've heard about it. They know it's magical. It's got all this. But I think that there's very few of those guys around to get it, that are younger. And it's the kind of thing where, like you said, like once there's not as many of us around, I don't know how the vintage guitar market's going to hold up. I don't. That's a great question. I hope it holds up, you know, for my children's sake.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, but it's a tough thing. It's how do you put a value on it? And right now, there's not really a current guitar hero out there.
Yeah, right.
A young guitar hero, mm-hmm. you know, like the last guy I could think of really is John Mayer. You know,
yeah. Yeah. That would be the name who would come up. Really quickly. That's the guy who is holding the fort with maybe Joe Bonamassa to a lesser extent because he's less well known than John Mayer. But it's not we are not living in the guitar hero era anymore. That's for sure.
No, It's Joe is a great guy, by the way. I love Joe. I don't know John, but Joe I know. And mm-hmm. Such a great guitarist. He's like, I played a gig with him. I begged. I'm like, I can't. I cannot do this. And he's like, you're fine. You're fine. But we had a great time. But I mean, the guy is just, he's so good.
Mm-hmm. So you only play vintage guitars and vintage amps and everything? Nothing new at the Jason Cine home studio?
Actually, no. I play a lot of new guitars. A lot. In fact, this is a brand new guitar I got last week. If you notice, big headstock.
Mm-hmm. Nice. What's that?
This is an Inca Silver 67 Strat from the custom shop. I had them build this. I just got it last week. Brand new guitar. Unbelievable. I have a few custom shop Strats that I love that I take on the road, and I play them at home. They're great, great guitars. I like Ronin guitars a lot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I like Music Man guitars
mm-hmm.
a lot. In fact, I had them make me one kind of similar color, and it was funny. I'd be playing this Les Paul, and then I would pick up this other guitar. And I'm like, you can literally buy 300 of these. But I love it. So I do love new instruments. And when they're, like, sometimes they just come out, like this one Strat I have, it's called a Mischief Maker from Fender Custom Shop. So it's got a Telecaster headstock, but it's got a big, fat Strat neck. Really powerful pickups. And I bought that guitar because I was doing a gig with Mike in Hawaii with some guys from the Grateful Dead, which is my favorite band. And I wasn't going to bring, I didn't know what to bring over to Hawaii. Mike said, I'll have a guitar for you. I said, no, I want to bring my own guitar. So I brought my Campbell Tow. I mean, I was just carrying all this stuff on a plane. And I ended up buying that Mischief Maker for that show. Mm-hmm. Literally for that show. And I went all over LA. I played maybe 15 custom shop Strats, and that guitar blew them all out of the water. So it's just about finding the right one, I think.
Mm-hmm. Nice. So we are still in the middle of the pandemic at the moment. So any idea what is going to be the next time you're going to be able to play with the Dirty Knobs on stage? You have no clue at the moment?
I mean, we really don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we keep pushing our tour back.
Okay. Yeah.
So, you know, I guess it just depends on what happens with this virus, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We get it under control.
Yeah.
It's really, I've never gone this long since I was 16 without playing live.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard.
Was there any plan to come to Europe?
We really want to.
Mm-hmm.
I know Mike really wants to. I really want to. It's been a dream of mine to play specifically in France.
Nice. Okay.
Something I didn't tell you was I've spent probably 8 months of my life in your country.
Really? Okay. What did
yes.
you do in France? So you must speak French. We must do this in French now.
When I was young, I could speak French, and then it went away.
Okay.
But my family just fell in love with France. So we would go every summer. We'd go. And then one summer, they rented a house in Antibes.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the most incredible experience, musical experiences, because I would take my acoustic guitar down to Juan Pen,
yeah,
open it up and jam. I was 16, and man, I met a lot of people. I made so many friends, and that was the first time I ever saw blues live. It was at a festival in Antibes. I was there one summer when Lenny Kravitz came through. I grew up with Lenny. He's a friend of mine.
Nice.
I saw Toto there, which they blew me away, actually. Lukather completely blew my mind. I was completely shocked at how good he was, even though I knew, but I'd never seen him live.
Yeah. You know?
He was amazing. So, yeah, I love it there. So I really want to. I want to play in Paris so bad, and I want to play in Nice. I don't know if that place is still there. This incredible venue, and I want to do it with the Dirty Knobs, so yeah. Bad.
That would be great. So, and the idea for the Dirty Knobs is to do, I guess, first a US tour. So it's going to be a club tour, or because Mike Campbell is so famous, it's going to be big stage, or basically you don't
both.
Know at the moment.
Both? Okay. Mike is so smart. He's so humble. He's a very humble guy. And he made it very clear. I don't want to play places that are too big. He goes, let's start reasonable. Mm-hmm. So we had basically club tour. So 500 to 1500, right? Seaters. We sold it out, and then we were opening for Chris Stapleton, huge. That was the idea. Then go back to a club tour, then jump on with Zach Brown, then go back to a club tour, then jump on with someone else and build it.
Because
the Knobs are a live band. The Knobs is all about our show, to me. I mean, the songs are incredible, but there's a thing that happens when we play live. Every show, there's always moments where we go off script and we go off into, we don't know what's going to happen. And that to me is sort of the magic. And it's not like the Grateful Dead or jam bands. We don't do it like that. It's much more controlled. It's out of control, but in control.
Okay. That's a good balance. Difficult yes. Balance to achieve, I guess, yeah. I suppose. All right. As a conclusion, Jason, what would be the word of wisdom you would like to share with musicians watching this or listening to this through the podcast?
Well, I mean, I'm not the wisest man in the world, and I never give advice unless I'm asked for it. But, you know, a lot of young musicians reach out to me on social media and ask me, you know, people want to play their songs, or what do you think of this lick? Or I have this one kid, he's like, you got to hear my dad. You got to hear my dad. He's so cute. And sometimes, you know, people will really want to talk to me, and I keep telling them, you don't want to hear my point of view on this. Then when I finally get it out, I say, look, if you're playing music for anything other than the love of playing music, you're already way off the tracks, because it's such a hard business, and the business is always changing. It's not what it was. It's going to change even more.
Mm-hmm.
And what I always say is, be able to do more than one thing. So, in other words, if you want to be a singer-songwriter, great, but be really good at singing, be really good at songwriting, and learn how to really play an instrument well. Learn arranging. Have a few things in your tool belt, and then you could stay in the game. Because, you know, a lot of people, when I say, be honest, what do you really want? They'll say, I want to be a star. And I say, thank you for admitting the truth, because we all want that. But, you know, I hit a point in my career when I finally just said in my 20s, you know, all I really want is the respect of musicians I respect. And then, of course, I started getting that, and it wasn't enough. I wanted more. but I realized, okay, be happy with what you have. But the main points are, you have to love it. I mean, I'm old. I'm 54. I play guitar 4 hours a day. I'm constantly striving to get better. But I love it. I'm not doing it because it's hard. I'm doing it because I have to.
And what are you working on? What do you want to make progress on?
Well, I mean, I'm writing a bunch of songs. I have a very odd process. I'm just sort of kind of coming out. All these riffs keep coming out. So I keep recording all these riffs, lyrical ideas, and then I'm slowly putting them together. But I have no sort of burning desire to hurry and push it or, you know. I just want it to be good.
All right. Jason, again, thank you very much for your time. It was a blast to be able to do this with you. Hopefully next time, so there won't be a Winter NAMM this year. It will be just a virtual edition, so I won't be coming to Los Angeles. But let's cross finger that someday in 2021, you will come to France. And maybe we can do a guitar in hand interview right here in Paris in my showroom. That would be pretty cool. All right.
I would love that. This was so fun. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for your time, Jason.
All right. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Pour le prix d'un magazine, abonnez-vous à la chaîne Guitare pour accéder aux vidéos intégrales. For the price of a magazine, subscribe to The Guitar Channel to access the full videos.